Services to order this Wednesday, March 2nd, and we are going to be having an informational meeting this morning on consumer-driven services, which is the brokerage model for serving people with developmental disabilities, but we're also going to be discussing how we'd apply that model to other areas. We'll also be conducting public hearings on House Bill 2479 and 2490, which have to do with doctors of podiatric medicine. So we will get started. I want to try to get done promptly at 10:30 today, so we'll try to keep to our time schedule. We're going to bring the presentation up in four panels, with the first panel being Catherine White with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities and Bev Heron with Resource Connections of Oregon. So I'll ask Catherine and Bev to come forward and introduce yourself and present. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I am here as a policy analyst with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. And I wanted to just very, very briefly set the context for the testimony that you're going to hear this morning and the overview of consumer and client-directed services. For the most part, the history of people with psychiatric, cognitive, and physical disabilities has been filled with ignorance, violence, shame, and isolation. In Oregon's not-too-distant past, we had a social policy that included sterilization, separating parents from their children, and segregation, life sentences to institutions, for only one reason, that of having a disability. Doctors and professionals determined what was best for individuals and their families. In more recent history, the voices of people with disabilities and their families have been raised in protest, and through the efforts of civil rights movements like the Independent Living Movement, the Self-Advocacy Movement, and others, people with disabilities and their families have demanded a right to have control over the services that they've received. The programs that you're going to hear about today are based on a philosophy of self-determination, the belief that people with disabilities can and should have the right to create a real life that includes freedom, the authority to control their services, support, and the responsibility to give back to the communities that they have received the assistance from. Self-determination is not a type of service, but an approach to structuring the way supports are made available to the people who need them. The independent support brokerages have been created as a model to assist people with disabilities to create a real life, and the brokerages have assumed basically seven functions. I have included the seven functions in the handout, but I just wanted to go over them very, very quickly. And this is an alternative model for providing supports that is being used widely in the developmental disabilities community and increasingly looking at other areas of service delivery for people with disabilities. And a service brokerage will assist individuals to determine their needs, assist customers to arrange and find resources, provide education, technical assistance on how to do that, act as a fiscal intermediary, in other words, to help control the money and make sure that everything is legal and all laws are being met, provide employment administrative support. Employing of support people is often a very complex situation. Brokerages assist with that. Facilitate community building and linkages with the community. This is not based on a philosophy that public funding is your total source of support, but it is based on a philosophy that communities and public funding combined are what makes a person have a real life. And assure monitoring of the services. We have several people here who are from the various brokerages to talk about how the brokerages operate, and several individuals who are customers or clients of those brokerages. Thank you.
Good morning, Representative Chair Billy Galto and members of the House Committee on Health and Human Services.
Before we proceed, since I'm acting chair, I can do this without asking permission. I've never heard the term brokerage before, so tell me what exactly a brokerage is.
I think we're going to be talking a little more about the brokerage, but the brokerages are nonprofit entities. They're called brokerages because they broker services. They have some public funding. They work with individuals to put together supports, including private funding, and they assist people planning. So the term brokerage is used because they're the entity out there kind of working to pull things together.
Okay, help me understand this a little bit better. What might that, what term might have been used before you used the term brokerage?
Agency.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Coordinator.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Good morning, Chairman Dalto and members of the House Committee on Health and Human Services. My name is Beverly Heron. I am the Director of Resource Connections of Oregon, one of nine support service brokerages in the state of Oregon. Our offices are housed here in Salem. We provide services to Lynn, Marion, and Yamhill counties. It has been just 3.5 years since the first support service brokerage opened its doors. In 2001, the first of what is currently nine independent support service brokerages was opened for services to eligible adults with developmental disabilities. Brokerages came into existence in response to the Staley lawsuit, a settlement issued by the federal court in 2000 and then renegotiated in 2003. This settlement ended class action litigation filed by Medicaid-eligible adults with developmental disabilities who had been on long wait lists for the services. As you know, prior to this, historically, services have generally been provided to people in 24-hour residential homes and generally often segregated employment settings. And these were often in communities not of the person's choosing, and many people went wherever there was a slot that could provide services to meet just their basic needs. The use of independent support brokerages as the vehicle for implementing the Staley Agreement grew out of a year-long planning process with all stakeholders. Statewide requests for proposals determined who would assume the independent support service brokerage role. Support service brokerages refer to people we serve as customers. Foundational to the system change was the self-advocacy by customers and their families in the design, implementation, and evaluation of support services. The movement of self-advocacy led to self-determination as the cornerstone philosophy of this service, developing a new level of self-reliance. The goal of individuals with developmental disabilities is to be more independent, productive, and engaged, and active citizens. An integral part of the brokerage design is the capacity development at the local level and connecting individuals receiving services to new opportunities in their communities. People want to stay in their communities and be a part of their communities. By having authority and responsibility over their services, customers are recognizing greater control over their lives. Customers who have been deemed eligible by county staff are referred to the brokerage on a scheduled rollout basis. The rollout phase is currently planned for completion in June of 2009, so we're still out there a ways in terms of when this model will be fully implemented. The first and primary benefit received by customers is the services of a personal agent. Agents coordinate the planning, implementation, and evaluation of services. The agents are also responsible for monitoring the individual budgets for services in the role of fiscal intermediary, providing tight controls on allocation of service dollars. Once in the brokerage, the personal agents work with the customers, families, and community members to develop an individual support plan. This plan is developed with the individual's personal preferences and choices for support and is completed within the capped budget amount. It's not a blank check. There are limits to what we can spend money on, and there's a maximum of what is allowed to be spent on each individual. The health and safety concerns of a customer are the first level of support need personal agents review. The individual support plan is a living document and is revised as the customer needs. It is a requirement to use all other funded or non-funded supports prior to authorizing the use of support service funds. Some examples of the use of support service funds are providing access to the communities in which people live through employment, community inclusion, and or community living support. An example of community inclusion and community living support might be, I'll talk about a woman we serve in Linn County, has moderate mental retardation, very difficult to understand, has some speech language problems going on, lives alone in her apartment. Her family is two sisters who live in the metro area. She's very happy in her apartment, has difficulty with neighbors coming over to borrow things from her. We have a support person involved in her life who comes in, checks things out, makes sure things are going well for her, helps her budget, helps her grocery shop. And this woman is a terrific knitter. What she loves to do is sit and knit. So the service provider has helped connect her with a volunteer program in Albany, in Linn County, where she's knit literally hundreds of caps for chemotherapy patients and newborn babies. So she's giving back to her community, and it's a provider who helps link this person. And we pay the supports to the providers, and they go out and do their knitting, and she is involved in her community that way. Other ways we help support people is by paying for respite for families who need to have a break, and non-medical transportation. Those are the five categories brokerages spend most of their, or people, customers in brokerages spend most of their money in. Most of the funds allocated for a customer's individual support plan are used to purchase supports and services provided in the local community. This is tax money that stays in the community. There's a multiplier effect, as you all know. Money is paid for wages, so taxes are taken out, etc. Once the plan is written and approved, the actual service provider is selected. All providers must meet the qualifications of being a Medicaid-qualified provider. Services are delivered upon completion of agreements between customers and providers. The provider selected by the customer may be an employee of the customer, an independent contractor, a general business, or a certified community agency. Personal agents are integral to this process. They help the customer fill out required documentation to become an employer. They help the customer interview providers and develop job descriptions or service contracts. It is that customer who holds the authority over their employees. Excuse me. They actually pick who their providers are, not an agency making that determination. Personal agents monitor the budgets and goals of the plan and, at a minimum, renew the plan annually through a standardized process. The role of personal agents represents the vast majority of the work done by the brokerage, as well as the greatest expenditure. Accountability measures are taken in multiple layers of the system. Independent support service brokerages have contract requirements such as state certification reviews, state field reviews, county authorization of plans and reviews of customer budget expenditures, an independent financial audit, quality improvement and quality assurance activities, and customer-driven policy or advisory boards for each brokerage. Budget efficiencies are controlled at the local and state level. The efficiency and effectiveness of the brokerage system in each of your communities is something for which you can be proud. Local brokerages will gladly provide specific details about their services and would love to visit with you during appointments. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Beth. Any questions or comments from the panel? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, I have a number of questions that this raises, but I don't know that they need to all be gone into in any formal arrangement here. I take it from this, Beverly, that Resource Connections of Oregon is a brokered contractor. Is that right?
Mr. Chair and committee members, I'm not sure I understand your question. We are a private not-for-profit social service agency. We have a contract with the state of Oregon to provide support service brokerage services to customers.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative Butler, just go ahead and ask your question.
Thank you very much. It says that you you receive your customers through county staff after they've been deemed to be eligible. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and committee members, yes. That's
so in that regard, you become the county's intermediary for the brokered services through the human resources. Human Services, disabled, the DD, developmentally disabled. Is that correct?
When I spoke earlier about involving all the stakeholders in developing the process, what we were able to design was a system where the brokerages contract directly with the states, and counties currently have case management responsibility for people living in their local areas.
Beverly, can I stop you there?
Sure.
Is there, you're saying that the state will now have a level of brokerage level before it gets to the county level. Is that what you're saying? A new level of...
No, I'm sorry. And I'm wondering if we should do a written response to your question.
Well, let me just continue on. I want to make certain it says that when you talk about accountability in the multiple layers of this system, I'm looking at the last full paragraph on page 3.
Correct.
It talks about several things that are required. Certification review, field reviews, authorization of plans, review of customer budget expenditures, financial audits, quality improvement, quality assurance activities, customer-driven policy boards, and advisory boards for each of the brokered services. Now, would all of those 7 or 8 items that you've got listed there, I'm an accountant by profession, and I'm seeing lots of dollar signs when I've got reviews, audits, advisory boards, policy-driven customer boards, and so forth. Are these subtracting from the amount of dollars that are available for the services that are being delivered by our actual delivery agents? I'm looking for the people who get the water to the end of the row, who actually meet. And I don't mean to be disparaging about Ms. White, but she doesn't see people on a daily basis that are DD that need the service. Do you? And then I'm looking. How do we best get the services delivered?
Correct. I'm not sure that I'm going to get again to the crux of your question, but I want to emphasize that the state regulates the services. Brokerages and counties are in a very working relationship to in order to provide services to
Mr.
people.
Chair, can I stop Beverly there? She's mentioning brokerage and counties at the same level. Are we adding 36? We've got 36 counties. The question I have is, are the brokers in addition? That's my question.
Let's let Beverly be able to finish her statement.
Right. I'm not sure on how to help you explain. We provide direct services to individuals.
Great.
About 10% of our budget is administrative costs. Those costs are separate. We are contracted separately between the administrative funds and the service dollars that go out to individuals.
Catherine, go ahead.
Chair Dalto and Representative Butler, there is a little diagram that shows that there's a separation of responsibility between what is county service and the brokerage service. The brokerages are really like a provider, like an employment, like what we know traditionally in our system as employment, residential providers. They hold a contract to provide support services to adults. And their focus is on actual delivery of services and making sure those services occur. There is a relationship because the county acts as the Medicaid entity for the state in making sure that funding and the Medicaid requirements are met. But people move into the brokerage for their direct service.
So let me see if I understand this. The brokerage, the county contracts with these nine brokerages, depending on which counties it applies to, contracts with these nine brokerages across the state. The county does not typically provide direct services, particularly when it comes to serving folks with developmental disabilities. They do not provide the direct services. So the county is passing through the Medicaid dollars and other dollars to the brokerages themselves, who then deliver the services at the direct level. And these tools here, statements in Beverly's testimony, the accountability measures, the field reviews, the county authorization plans, the budget expenditures, independent financial audits, these are all just systems within your brokerage itself to ensure that the money is being appropriately spent, supported, and that you're getting the maximum amount of dollars to serving those individual clients. And these are not, in fact, additional layers of bureaucracy, but just your sort of quality systems within your brokerage itself to make sure that you're maximizing the dollars for the individuals. Is that right?
Chair Dalto, I just want to correct one thing. As you see, these brokerages work with multiple counties, and as we looked at what would be the most efficient way to do that contracting, the state does direct contracts with the counties. So the money flows directly from the state to the brokerages because they serve multiple counties. Otherwise, it would have put the counties in the position of having to contract multiple counties and the complexity of that. So it was an effort to simplify it that way. Other than that, you are correct. And many of the things that Bev referred to are a combination of what is normal fiscal procedure for any nonprofit, what are other requirements in the use of public funds. And so it is a combination. What you see here is a combination of different kinds of oversight that, in fact, are not duplicative.
Representative Greenlee?
Yeah, I would like to talk just a bit about that oversight, and to put it in a metaphor we've heard here, the process has to do with getting water to the end of the row, and there are two issues in that. One is to make sure the row is the one where the crops are to be grown, getting water down the right row, and that has to do with making sure the services get to the people who actually need them. And the other is making sure that the water that's getting to the row isn't salinated or some other way, some other water that's not going to do the job to help the crops grow. I've been very impressed when I hear about brokerages or about your ability, particularly with patient-directed services, the notion that the patients ought to be, your clients ought to be able to determine what services they need. In other words, what crops are to be watered. How much is your oversight really determined in making sure that the water is flowing down a row where the patients, your customers, want the crops to be grown rather than down some other row?
Chair Dalto and Representative Greenlee, we talk about scratching people where they itch. And we have a very strong oversight of consumers, family members, and other organizations that meet on a regular basis to evaluate how these programs are going, looking at efficiency, and trying to assure that, in fact, the dollars are getting where they need to go.
Thank you.
So do you gain efficiencies by contracting with multiple counties? That's my first question. My second question is, how many counties are served by these nine brokerages, and does it cover the entire state?
Chair Dalto, yes, every county in the state is served by the nine brokerages. And we believe that this is a very cost-effective way of delivering services.
All right. Additional questions or comments from the panel? Representative
Buck. Mr. Chair, I guess seeing is believing in this regard. My concern is that in the past 6 weeks that the committee has had testimony regarding delivery of services, particularly those to those counties who may be more rural and less populated, we have seen that there are organizations already in place, consortiums of counties that have gathered together that serve all 36 counties. I am concerned that adding brokerage services through and particularly I'm concerned about our more rural counties, those on the coast and those in eastern Oregon, that have services brokered through a brand new network of brokerage firms, how we're going to be able to, number one, assure ourselves that we're not expending more money in adding this new layer, as opposed to those consortiums of counties that already exist to deliver mental health services. And I thought that up until just the most recent change of one of the departments within the DHS, that the developmental disabilities was part of the mental health and developmental disabilities and seniors and other folks. And it seems like to me that while Oregon has gone through a fairly significant budget crisis, that we've been able to come up with a brand new layer of administration before we actually get the right water to the right row. And I'm concerned about that. If I guess my comment to the committee would be, if it was demonstrated that we weren't getting the water to the right row before, when we had more resources to do that, why would we add a new layer of administration at this particular time in order to assure ourselves that we were getting that we'll get future resources to the right folks? And I just would like to hear more, and I know that you have more folks to testify.
Representative Butler, I'm a little unclear. Are your concerns about the brokerage system that it's already in place with the 9 brokerages around the state serving the developmentally disabled? Or are you concerned? Is your concern extend to some sort of future brokerage model?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding from testimony which has been given before this committee in the past that service delivery organizations already exist for the delivery of services for these folks, including developmental disabilities from the past, and providing services for these folks under an existing delivery system without adding, and most of those are consortiums of counties. We've received their names in prior committee hearings that service all 36 counties. My concern is as the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities gone out and encouraged the organization of new brokerage entities in order to deliver the same services that we were previously having delivered through what I thought were pretty effective, very well managed, and low administrative cost organizations. And if we're saying that the same administrative costs will now just be shifted over to a new series of entities, and that we're going to get the same work done or better work done, or if there was some indication, Mr. Chair, that the committee members know about, that we were receiving insufficient services or inappropriate or inadequate services with the dollars that were available to us, my concern is that this just appears to be an additional group of folks that I have never seen before. I've never seen any of these. And I appreciate the fact that my district is being serviced out of Hood River at this particular point in Eastern Oregon Support Brokerage, and it always concerns me that that folks say Eastern Oregon and are in a place where they can't see the Mount Hood in the rearview mirror. So,
yeah.
Again, this is a brand new delivery brokerage service.
Don't know what
was wrong with the old one.
This is not a brand new service. Representative Butler, this service is in place. It's been in place for a couple of years, and it's a magnificent way to serve people at the local level who need this assistance, who were previously served under a very cumbersome system that wasn't client-centered. It was case management-centered. It was paperwork-centered. And what's special about the brokerage model, when you go out and you spend some time to the individual brokerages, is how the person at the end of the row that you refer to is the person who is the focus of everything that is being accomplished at the brokerage through the brokerage services. We have had a sea change in this state in how we have cared for and provided services to people with developmental disabilities. It used to be that we institutionalized people. We threw them away in institutions like Fairview and the other institutions and forgot about them. And we don't do that as a society anymore. We want people to live in our community. We want people to share the same experiences as we do. And we want people to be able to make their own decisions about how they want to be served with state dollars. They are entitled to these state dollars. dollars, but there are also human beings entitled to make their own decisions. And what the brokerage model has done has come about to support the individual in making that decision and giving them the support that they want to be able to move forward. So we are not creating something new. This is already in place, and it's an effective system to deliver these services to the folks. The state cannot be the party that is delivering services to folks like this at the local level, because they are not able to do it in an effective way, in a caring way, in a way that puts the client at the center. And that is what the brokerage system does. And that's what we wanted to have folks come in and explain how well the system is working that's in place already. I appreciate that Oregon is a big place, and it may be that the brokerage that serves Ontario, and is it Malheur County?
Yes, House District 60.
House District 60. I appreciate that the services may be being provided out of Hood River, and it loses a local context and a local flavor to a very, very large geographic portion of the state. And I'd like to get a little more information about that to see if we can figure out how to get more of a local contact to those kind of services. But let's move on. Let's let these people finish their presentation, move on with the discussion, and then we can have a discussion later on about whether or not the brokerage system is appropriate.
But thank you, Mr. Chair. I thought it was appropriate while we have the information hearing with Catherine White here from the Oregon Council of Developmental Disabilities, that perhaps this and recognize, please, if you would, Mr. Chair, that neither of your vice chairs had heard about this brokerage system until just a few minutes ago. But this was one of the questions that the other vice chair raised, that she had not heard of the term brokerage being used in this regard in the past, and I personally had not. And I guess someone will have to convince me that the old system was broke.
Well, we'll convince you, Representative Butler, just because nobody has heard about this program, it doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. I've known about this program since 2002 when I was first running for office, and I can't be responsible for people saying that they don't know about the program if they don't go care to check, you know.
Could I just
go ahead, Representative Greenlee?
Thank you, Chair Delta. When I was campaigning for office, I think in 2002, some folks called me together to talk about the needs of severely disabled young adults that were being cared for in their own home by their parents. And it was a very moving experience because, in addition to having a group of parents, there were two severely disabled young people from Sunset High who were in wheelchairs and part of the room. And it's very unfortunate life, but we tend to pretend we don't see people sometimes who are that severely disabled. It's uncomfortable for us. And as I was discussing with the parents, the burden of their inability to get services to keep people in their home, they could get plenty of state services if they were willing to give their kids up to be institutionalized, but they couldn't get services in trying to take care of these, take the burden for their own children. The thing that I noticed as this conversation was going on at the intellectual level with the parents, the policy level, is these two young people were sitting and flirting with each other in the wheelchair. All of a sudden I noticed this kind of side action going on with these two probably 16-year-olds, I think they were both at that age, kind of smiling and giggling and flirting and carrying on the way any two teenagers I would expect to do, being bored by conversations that their parents were having with somebody running for office. And it came home to me in a very visceral way how disabled people have a right to live their life in a way that has meaning to them. And these parents were very much engaged at that point in the negotiations. It must have been the renegotiations with the Staley suit kinds of things. And all they were asking for was very modest things that would help them do what their kids wanted to have happen to them. And it got me to follow this this settlement stuff, including the brokerage services, which, while somewhat different from the way services had been provided before, is really designed, as we heard, for the self-determination models for these disabled people, allowing them across a whole range of disabilities to be able to live with their parents, if that's what's needed, and to get the services to help that, be able to live on their own, if that's what's needed. And it is an alternative system, in a sense, from the system that we had before in counties. But what it creates is the ability to have a client-determined way to live their life and to provide the support services that go along with that. And in fact, there's a special fund of money that's set aside for this. This isn't competing with the dollars for other dollars for the care of the disabled because of the settlement out of that suit. So I think what we have, and it's very important to hear this, is this may not even be the most efficient way to do it. For their parents would be the most efficient way would have been to turn the kids over and have them institutionalized and have the state pay the whole cost. But that would not have been efficient from the perspective of the state. And we might have had the services better controlled, but what we would have had instead are these people not being served the way that they wanted to be served, and a much heavier state burden than we're creating by this. So I do want to commend the folks, and I hope we'll continue to hear more about this as it goes on, this sense of brokering services that allow disabled people to live their lives in a way that they want to live their lives, however we think they might want to live them, is a very, I believe it's a very powerful model, and I really do want to congratulate these folks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. Representative Anderson, I hesitate because I want to move on before the good representative from Ontario comes back to slow down our progress.
No.
Go ahead, Representative Anderson.
Well, I guess I'm kind of a peacemaker like Representative Greenlink here. I agree that there's some wonderful services that parents and grandparents and family members are making sacrifices to take care of folks who are disabled. But on the other hand, I think that Representative Butler was trying to make a point that I think we all need to keep in mind. We're not a Ways and Means Committee here, but we need to be cautious. I remember watching our Rogue Valley Council on Governments, who had taken over senior services, go 10 years ago from 3 employees to now 140. And we need to be watching carefully the efficiency. I appreciate that this brokerage is working at a 10% administrative cost. I hope that's going to continue to be true. But there are, just by the nature of government, increases that slide by very carefully, very quickly and very quietly, and I think that's what Representative Butler was warning us to, that we need to be careful that we can do this within the budgets we have.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Representative Cameron.
I just want to thank you for coming, and I'm looking at my agenda, and it says informational meeting, and I want to compliment the chair for allowing this to come forward, because this is the first time I've heard about it, and I believe that's what we were here for, was to become educated, and I want to thank you for your time today.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Go ahead with your testimony. Are you done?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks very much. Thank you, panel, for being here. Next, we'll call up Marvin Wood and Deborah Wood, our second panel.
Chairman Donfell, committee members, I'm Marvin Wood, and this is my daughter Deborah. Pardon me, I'm a little nervous.
It's okay.
My wife and I have 4 children and 3 grandchildren. We live in Salem, and we attend Salem Alliance Church. My reason for being here today is to relate our story. My daughter Deborah here is 52 years old, lives at home with my wife and me. She's legally blind, has autism, and mild retardation. Deborah has been at Shangri-La Corporation for 30 years in their sheltered workshop program and is on a grounds maintenance crew. This has been a very constructive process for Debbie and a godsend to my wife and myself. The support, the sheltered workshop jobs is very important to the DD population. When the Staley settlement agreement became effective, Deborah was included in the Integrated Services Network Support Services Brokerage. A personal agent was assigned to her to get to know Deborah, her individual strengths, relationships, and resources, her family members, and home environment. This process resulted in a provider service agreement for Deborah with Shangri-La Corporation. This not only spells out Deborah's preferences and goals, but includes rights, responsibilities, and choices. Now, I want to say that under the county case management, we saw the case manager once a year at the annual review. They didn't get to know Debbie. They didn't get to know us. We had one county caseworker that did take the time, and within a couple of years, he was promoted. So in this case, the personal agent got to know us. Living in our home, Deborah socializes with our friends and neighbors, as well as her own friends in the Marion County Integrated Services Network Brokerage and the Shangri-La Corporation and the community at large. When I'm downtown in some stores, the clerk will call out Debbie's name because she's been down shopping, so she gets around downtown. As you can tell, I'm an aging parent with a limited amount of time left to advocate for Debbie, and I would like to think that a support system such as we have can be in place to sustain Deborah as she ages. Any questions?
Mr. Wood? Oh, Debbie, go ahead.
I work for Shangri-La All Seasons Groundskeeper.
Okay.
I mow and blow and pick and poke and pick up trash and pruning, pick up pruning and rake leaves and blow leaves, mow and pull weeds.
You enjoy that?
Yes, all over.
Super. Yeah. You have friends down there that you work with?
Yes.
Is that a pretty good environment?
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to do?
Oh, I like all jobs outdoors.
Mm-hmm. It's a terrific work ethic. I wish I had it.
Rain or freezing, but he goes for it.
There you go. Well, Mr. Wood.
It's all over.
Debbie, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Are you able to tell me the difference between the brokerage model and the services that you received before?
The county slot is from the state, and the brokerage is from Shangri-La.
Right, and is it better or worse than it was before?
Better. The brokerage helped me better.
Why?
Because we're not funded differently.
Okay. Mr. Wood, maybe you could tell me from your family's perspective, could you elaborate? You said under the county, in your statements, under the county case management, you only saw your caseworker once a year. And
that was in July.
That was in July. And so, and the person moved on and you lost the sort of continuity of care there. How is that different than what you're able to, what Deborah's able to have from the case, from the brokerage model?
Sir Dalto, of course, we've been in this just 2 years, but we've had the same personal agent. And we have in the brokerage, in our Marion County Council, within the brokerage, which is about 110 customers. We plan socials, all volunteer committees. We plan socials and fundraisers and things to get the clients together, to get them out into the community and to get to know each other.
You know, I think that the sense of community is a lot different. It, just in my short perspective of being in the legislature and being aware of the brokerage system, I've been out to visit a lot of events and meetings where there are customers. And I think what strikes me, first of all, and we'll hear from Mr. Lopez in a moment, but the real effort that our local brokerage here in Marion County, the Integrated Services Network, does to engage the community and provide these events for the clients. And it's, to me, what's special about it is a real family feeling. And I get to see people, and I get to see people over the months and years, and everybody seems to be pretty happy with that community feeling.
Well, and the customers get to put in their own input. I mean, these plans are their plans, or they plan to get together. So they're doing the activities.
Okay.
So, and our it's volunteer for policy committee or finance committee or quality control committees, all volunteer committees. And I'm on the policy committee, and we volunteer our time for those things. Any other questions?
Why can we use the microphone?
We use the microphone?
You like the mic?
Now you're on the internet, and people can hear you anywhere.
You won't let go.
My stuff in the garage. I love it.
Perfect. Okay, thanks for coming down, Deborah.
We didn't use the microphones.
We did.
We used, yeah, you sure did. They're pretty sensitive. They pick you up. Thank you very much. We'll call the third panel forward, please. Adrian Young, Rick Snook, and Gina Johnson. Johnston.
Visual aids.
How exciting. We don't get visual aids often, so.
We're here to wake you up this morning with the visual.
Well, good morning. Welcome. If I could ask you to introduce yourself before you speak, go ahead and proceed.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Adrian Young, and I'm from Portland, and I'm the Executive Director of Empowerment Initiatives Incorporated. And I've been diagnosed with severe recurrent depression, general anxiety, and obsessive compulsive disorder. I've been hospitalized because of my mental health issues, but find my history with mental health issues as an asset now. I was hired on March 8, 2004 by Oregon Technical Assistance Corporation, which is actually here in Salem, to develop a brokerage for 25 people with mental health issues living in Multnomah County. The Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services with DHS received funding from the Federal Real Choice Systems Grant and awarded Oregon Technical Assistance Corporation with $240,000. My role when hired was to use these funds for 18 months to create a brokerage and start a nonprofit run by people with mental health issues. In January of 2005, our application for a 501c3 nonprofit status was approved. I am now the formal executive director of Empowerment Initiatives, and we have created a subcontract with OTAC to manage the remainder of the budget, excluding the customer expenditures. This is the first time in the nation a brokerage for people with mental health issues is run by people with mental health issues, and it's been successfully created. The brokerage received referrals from two Multnomah County providers, mental health providers, Cascadia and Lutheran Community Services. Once a customer applied for services, they were selected on a first-come, first-served basis and put on an enrollment list. When we received 25 applications, we began entering customers into the brokerage. The services we offer to our customers once their enrollment month arrives is a group entry meeting explaining the brokerage system, and this is an opportunity for other people to meet each other. We also do group and individual planning sessions and tools to learn how to do their own planning. A facilitated person-centered plan is done, and an action plan outlining specific one-year goals with objectives towards reaching those goals are created. Resources to meet their goals include natural resources already in the community and up to $3,000 the brokerage provides. Oregon Technical Assistance Corporation provides fiscal intermediary services for the customer's funds. Customers are only allowed to spend the money on items or services leading to obtaining their goals, creating independence, and improving their mental health cost-effectively and safely. Each plan is approved by the Office of Mental Health and Addiction Services to ensure funds are spent accordingly. When our customers were entered into the brokerage, we conducted a baseline survey covering areas such as employment, education, satisfaction with their current mental health services prior to coming to us, and their own feeling of empowerment and self-esteem, rated by them on a 4-point scale. In all of these areas, there was improvement across the board. When the brokerage started, 5 customers were competitively employed, and now after only 6 months, and only one person, and she's sitting next to me, has actually been in the program 6 months because it was on a tiered schedule, now 9 people are competitively employed. 6 people were enrolled in formal education, and now 11 people are out of 25. So if you combine those two numbers, you're looking at almost 75% of our customers either actively employed or actively working on getting employed through education. We expect these numbers to continue to go up as we reach the end of the grant period in September 2005. We are also monitoring individual progress on goals. When we looked at 9 plans in progress for an average of 6 months, we were pleased to see customers were right on track with 65% of their one-year goals being either completed or almost completed. And these goals include things like owning a home, having a job, having children live with them again that weren't living with them, major goals in their life. The brokerage model is effective in making a difference in a short period of time. For instance, one of our customers in her early 30s on welfare with 3 children would stay at home all day while her kids were in school. Poor role modeling in her life and consistent abuse left her feeling incapable of reaching her goals. She consistently felt isolated, depressed, and worthless. Since being in the brokerage, she was able to get a Pell Grant, a loan, and the brokerage paid for $500 of her remaining tuition, which was a huge barrier for her, so that she could go to school to become a dental assistant. Her self-esteem has improved dramatically, and she has become a better role model for her children. Another individual had a traumatic history witnessing her mother being shot by her stepfather at age 5, being kidnapped and sexually abused for her entire childhood. She had not been able to go to public places without having panic attacks and sees blood on her car window when it's raining. Since starting in the brokerage, she's enrolled in classes to help her learn how to write a book about her life story. One of the purchases with brokerage funds allowing her to succeed in this class was a recorder to verbalize her ideas when they were racing in her head, and then she was able to write them down later. This is a very therapeutic process for her. Her panic attacks have decreased, and she is now volunteering for a sexual assault crisis line. As someone who's been on both the receiving end and the giving end of social services, I have not witnessed a model so effective at motivating people and facilitating successful outcomes as the brokerage model has. Thank you for your time.
Adrian, pretty remarkable personal story for yourself to be in a tough situation, turn it around, and start this empowerment initiatives brokerage.
Thank you.
It's pretty amazing, pretty remarkable. I want to ask you how you think the sense of community is an important part of what you're able to accomplish with your clients.
I'm really thankful that our funding allows people to do things like go to school and take classes. The woman I mentioned who had panic attacks is actually taking a doll making class, and she has met other women, and she can actually get through this class without having a panic attack, and that is really amazing considering the trauma that she's lived with. And I think that over time, as a society, we've gone away from community and we've become more isolated as individuals. We don't talk to our neighbors. People don't gather around. We don't cook meals when somebody breaks their leg. We don't look out for each other's children. And I think this is a step back in the right direction of finding natural resources. I consider the brokerage a stepping stone and for people to enter into the community. My goal and everyone that I work with is creating interdependence, not dependence and not necessarily independence, but creating a self-esteem, a sense of worth and belief that I instill in everybody that I work with, that you can do it, and that if you can conceive where you want to be and you have the support, then you can achieve your goals. I believe that because I've lived that and I've seen people live that.
Thanks very much.
Chief Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Adrian. I had a question regarding the, you indicated your initial funding was for empowerment initiative brokerage was federal funding.
Mm-hmm.
Do you receive state funding, and are you bidding on any of the contracts for delivery of state services at this point?
That's an excellent question. We're working on looking at long-term funding. Since this was a pilot project, we are being very diligent about taking good data so that we can show the outcomes, Representative Butler, that you were mentioning before, because I think it is important to say, is it working? And I want to see how it's working, not just anecdotally, but statistically as well. And so I'm working hard to create that data. We are looking at potential block grants combined with county funding. Currently, the customers that we're serving are still receiving their current mental health services. But ironically, they're not using them because they're not effective. And they tend to rely on the services that I am providing. As a matter of fact, three of our customers helped to create a client council for a current mental health provider that they're very dissatisfied with. So it's interesting to see the leadership that they're taking and even trying to impact their current services.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you very much. Gina.
Okay. Mr. Chair and member of the committee, my name is Gina Johnson. I'm a customer of Empowerment Initiative from Portland. I'm sorry, I've never done this.
Don't be nervous.
I put together this board. I've done two presentations on how it has affected my life the last 6 months, so you can glance at that, but I'll do an overview. I know I have short time. I'm going to talk about my history, my process in the empowerment. I almost been in it in a year, and then some outcomes, 11 items that I've had negative and now they're positive. 10 years ago was my worst time of my mental illness. I still can struggle with it, but I can catch it before it gets into too bad of a spot. 5 years ago, I had moved from Pendleton, being there for 4 years, was not happy with the services. I was not getting anywhere. I was rehashing my past and not dealing with my moments. So I'm really appreciating that I live in Portland and was able to be with this brokerage. I also, from 13, I was very promiscuous. I was not safe. I would sleep with people. And I was also controlled by my ex-husband and family members and friends. I was leaving my husband 10 years ago and got manipulated to him that I couldn't take my children. So the last 10 years I've had to struggle with being a mom but not being able to physically see them every day. With all of that, I also have a learning disability that I've had to struggle with. Having my dad be a school teacher really put pressure on me to try to be normal. But with all of that, I've also become a PAMI member. And last year I was a vice chair, and this year I'm starting to be a chair. And if you don't know what PAMI is, it's under the Oregon Advocacy Center, and they work with mental health people and advocate for them. I'm going to talk a little bit about the process. I've done this last year. I have 4 main goals, is to get more hours, to be spiritual, and to self-care and have a home. I've had many resources been brought to my attention that I've used with the $3,000, and that was 10 of them. I also came up with 10 natural resources, such as using the internet to locate a church that now I attend, and I have had support with my parents to get some lotion that I used to have a really red face, which would cause more barriers for me to communicate with people. I also am working on getting off disability. Previously, a year ago, I only was working 5 hours. Now, since October, I worked 20 hours. First of this year, now I'm working 25, so now I'm at a total of 30 hours a week, which was 5 a week. So I'm pretty proud of myself. And with that, I'm going to work on getting insurance through them because I'm going to continue to take my medication. And the job that I've been experiencing with for the last 4 years is working with other mental health consumers, and it helps me grow and helps them relate to me better. And that also will get me to work on getting my girls back, which is a lot of important things. I also have an anxiety over germs, so the brokerage has helped me to bring a house cleaner in and work through some of those issues and become aware that not everything is just thinking through that. Also, speaking up and being assertive today is a big experience because I like to know every little detail so my anxiety is not there. But today I've decided that you care and you want to listen, or I wouldn't be here. So I've got through that. Now I have 11 items. I don't have them memorized. If I keep looking down, that's why. The first one, I felt walked over and hopeless, and now I feel empowered. 2, timid and lack of expression, and I took a self-esteem class. I felt worthless, and now I have a spiritual life. 4, I had not had confidence, and now I share my skills and beliefs. Not appreciated, and now I see the little steps. I had a foggy mind, and now I do self-care to have a peace of mind. I used to deny what I observed, and now I speak my truth. I'm inconsistent with my needs, and now I ask for my needs and my boundaries. I used to run away, which I wanted to today, but I got through it and I'm here today. I used to worry about the past and the future, but I stay in the present moment. I used to worry about judgment, and the brokerage has shown me compassion. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Gina. Important goals that you've set for yourself and important steps that you've managed to achieve. And
Mr. Chair, it's not our protocol to applaud, but you need to know that we're all applauding you in your activities.
Thank you, Representative Greenlake. Gina, how do you think that you'd have been able to succeed? Do you think you'd have been able to succeed to the point that you are in moving towards your goals of stronger family relationship with your children, home ownership, independence, without the brokerage model?
I might have done it in my life. I think my kids would have already been out of school by the time I would have got there. A year ago, I went through dialectical behavior therapy, and they created mission plans for 1, 3, and 5 years. That's all they did. I would go to counseling once a month, and that's as far as they got. And with this path, it really narrowed it down, so that's why I worked really diligent this last year. If not, I would still have those mission statements.
And so what sort of services were you receiving before you started working with this brokerage?
I was going to Cascadia, and I was going to support groups, and I was seeing my psychiatrist and a counselor, and I was there regularly, but wasn't making the steps that I wanted to be. I'm not even the person you would have saw a year ago. I don't know how to answer that.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Yes, Representative May.
How did you find the brokerage? How were you referred there?
I was a client at Cascadia, and my counselor had 5 people he could refer, and I was one of the qualified out of the 5 to take this opportunity.
A follow-up. So what qualified you for that? Maybe that's something.
I was taking my medication regularly. I wanted to continue to grow, and I was at a point that I wanted to grow. I wasn't in a crisis mode. Mm-hmm. I was wanting to move forward.
You were really motivated.
And Representative Tomei, do you mind if I add on to that?
Please.
We wanted to work with the existing providers so that we didn't alienate them in this process. So we wanted them to be involved. We also wanted to make sure that people were coming to us in a state that they wanted to move forward in their life, because I think that's critical. I don't think you can push somebody into something if this is a lot about choice, which is what this program is about. And it can work with people in crisis, but with such a short amount of time, we wanted to make sure that we were able to have people that were dedicated to making the most out of 1 year.
And that is the short amount of time that people are allowed, is 1 year. Is that's how long your program is?
It's 18 months, and we did 5 entries every month starting in April. So our last plan will end in September 2005. Gina was the first plan to be written, and hers ends in May or April?
April.
So she's coming up on a year.
Thank you. Thank you, Gina.
Yeah. Representative Boone.
And I just wanted to add, it sounds to me like, and that's, he's answered the one question, is what happens to the medical part of it, the psychological treatment continues, and this probably picks up, sounds like it picks up a more community-based, more layperson approach and buddy system or whatever of things that you would not get in a normal clinical setting in that sense, which sounds like it's expanding on it and it's picking up what Representative Anderson and Representative Butler always say, is that we're responsible for ourselves. And it's, I think it sounds like it's a great example of becoming more responsible for yourself, ourselves, in this setting. And I guess, I don't know how I'm trying to say this, just like a flower blooming. It's like the main medical part. You have to have that. You have to have your medication, your treatment, your counseling. But this is, it goes beyond to help you really fit into the world again. So.
Can I respond to Representative Boone? Is that right? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've noticed with having control over the dollars that you spend, it's like any of us. If we have control over a budget, we're more invested in spending it wisely. I notice that when people just show up for services, they think it's free. They truly don't, in other service systems, they don't understand that nothing is free. We all pay for this. And so it's easy to show up and not take the most out of that event. It's easy to show up to a DBT class and not really put in your full effort. It's easy to see your counselor or cancel on your counselor. But with this situation, you say, I have $3,000. That sounds like a lot, but it's also not that much. And you're looking at that and you're saying, what can I purchase with this? Do I need, you know, for Gina, one of the things was a sound spa in the morning so that she could listen to it because her cat would meow and it would drive her up the wall and she couldn't concentrate and she'd be stressed for the day. It's $20 at Target. And that was, that little thing helped her to center herself in the morning, which helped her to do a better job when she got to work, more confident. These are the kinds of things where when people have choice and control, they take back their life and they're accountable for their success. No more excuses. And you look in the mirror and you say, I can do this, and I have the choice and the resources.
President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gina, what a remarkable story. You said that you were 5 years in Pendleton. Can you just relate that experience?
I had just got off of crank and drinking for almost 8 months and not being on my medication. I was working on trying to get my life back in order. Wasn't having my medication working for me. The counselors just couldn't get that piece, that light bulb go off that said, aha, this is what it's going to take to get it fixed. And I didn't have the support that I needed. I had people that wanted to keep me on the path that I was on so habitly. It was out of habit. And so I finally moved closer to Portland, in Portland. And so...
Okay. Thanks very much. And Rick Snook.
Hello, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rick, and I'm from Portland. I'm a member of the Empowerment Initiative's Board of Directors, and I was also the first person to open up a brokerage in the DD system in response to the Staley settlement back in 2001. I'm also someone that has a diagnosis of recurrent depression and post-traumatic stress disorder. It's something that has always bothered me. I guess it's a pet peeve that people who experience mental illness are seen in a certain light by the community, and it's not a very flattering light. We're held responsible for our illness. We're thought by others to have some kind of moral defect. Some people look at us and say, just quit acting crazy. We endure incredible prejudice and stereotypes from those who have, even from those who have sympathy for us, and those who are paid to provide services to us. And these supports and services are not just so minimal as to be absurd. They are delivered often in a paternalistic manner that completely overlooks the individual's authority in their own life. I serve on the board of empowerment initiatives, and one of the things that we're doing right is the EI board is composed of people who experience mental illness. This gives us a perspective we would not otherwise enjoy. We are also people with a lot of experience. We are lawyers and executive directors of corporations. We are socialists and activists. social workers and activists, sorry. And we all believe in the concept. We believe in the imperative that everyone should be given the basic respect of making the important choices in their lives, including how resources are used to support them in living their life to the fullest. Traditionally, the delivery of social services, whatever model, whatever facility or place, is a process that robs the individual of his or her basic self-respect. If you tell me what I need and then give it to me, you reinforce my helplessness. At the same time, your services may also be wide of the mark of what I really need. If, on the other hand, you ask me instead of telling me, you'll get an answer that will absolutely be more on target, and I will keep my self-respect. The brokerage system, as illustrated by empowerment initiatives, is giving people experiencing mental illness the chance to move beyond helplessness into a world of choices, authority in our own lives, and the freedom to dream. Brokerages are all about asking and about helping people reach the goals that they set for themselves. I've been on both sides of the system that treats and supports people with mental illness. It isn't working, but it's not just broken. It is underfunded to a horrific degree, but it's not just fiscally bankrupt. Its soldiers are burned out, but it doesn't just need a heart transplant. It should have collapsed under the weight of its own silliness years ago. What are we to do? The Empowerment Initiative brokerage is pointing the way, but it's a long, long way. Self-determination and social services, in this case, services for those of us with mental illness, is not just the latest fad. It's not just the model of the year. It is something really new, extremely simple, and like my teenage son says, it cries out, duh. Ask people what they need before you give it to them. Simple. It's the only way you can help others in a respectful manner. It is a manifestation of basic respect for the humanity in each of us. It throws pies in the face of every bureaucracy it touches. If you take one thing from my testimony today, hear this. People who have mental illness are just like you and me. We all deserve an opportunity to make the choices and decisions that are important in our lives. We all deserve the dignity of defining our own success.
Thank you very much, Rick. Any questions or comments from the panel? All right. I think you captured it all. Thanks very much. We thank the panel for being here.
Thank you.
And finally, we'll have Francisco Lopez with the Integrated Services Network, which is the local brokerage, come forward and wrap things up. And hopefully we can get through that as quickly as possible so that we can get on to the public hearings. But would you welcome you, Francisco?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of this committee. I'm Francisco Lopez. I'm the director of the Integrated Services Network that is based here in Salem. We are affiliated with Catholic Community Services of the Mid-Willamette Valley. My brokerage serves close to 500 adults with developmental disabilities in 8 counties. Many of those counties are in rural areas in the coastal area here in the Mid-Valley. Mr. Chairman, members of this committee, what you heard today are, you know, from mental health consumers and families and also from developmental disabilities, a new system that is consumer-driven, value-driven, and it is more cost-effective, a system that is getting the money follow the person, not the other way around, a system that is more in tune with the president's initiative of money follows the person, that we're very glad that values the consumer's perspective, what the consumer thinks is the best way to address his or her issues. And what we see, Mr. Chairman, here are the basis for a new social contract on the delivery of health and human services. One is that it bases on the value of self-determination, person-centered planning, consumer oversight, real consumer oversight, where there are family supports, where there is some level of funding flexibility, where there is more service integration and more reduction in administrative costs. I'm proud to say that my brokerage only spent 10% of their overall budget administration, where we have a program where 100% of support services dollars go into the customers. A system that is based on choice, hope, dignity, and integration. What we see is a new way of doing things, a new social contract that is very well deserved and many consumers of health and human services are waiting for. And we're here today, and we are very thankful to, I want to acknowledge the chairman because he's become a champion and an advocate for adults with developmental disabilities and consumers of mental health services. This is the first time, and I remember since being here in Oregon, that, you know, the we do things that make sense, and is listen to the consumer, what the consumer wants, and what they want to run their life. So I'm very thankful to that, and I just want to thank you again. I think this is something that is spreading to other groups and consumers that are thinking, you know, we need to do this in a different way. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of this committee, for listening to testimonies today and for information. And I just would like to say, I know Representative Butler has some questions, and we'll make sure that perhaps you can meet with consumers of your region to talk with them about how they feel about the brokerage program and how this is not a duplication, but actually is a different level of providing services that is more consumer-based and consumer-friendly, and that is indeed it's more cost-effective. So thank you very much.
All right. Thank you so much, Francisco. Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much. I appreciate Mr. Lopez's testimony, and I do appreciate your advocacy on behalf of those individuals with developmental disabilities, Francisco. And I think by putting some real faces on these issues today, and particularly with regard to the relationship of the brokerage. Here's a brand new word for me on the delivery of services. Where developmentally disabled individuals are buying services for fixed fees from actual brokers. I think this places a whole new concept for me individually on this. And as Rich Snook said, it throws pies in the faces of the bureaucracy. And that's something that I appreciate now.
Well, thank you, Representative Butler, Mr. Chairman. And as I say, you know, the way that this program was started was by the consumers that you heard today, the families themselves. It was great. And we're so proud of this program and the over 4,000 men and women that are served by the brokerage and around the state of Oregon. Thank you.
Francisco, before you leave, can you explain to us, elaborate on that concept of how the families really got this brokerage model started? Because that's my first interaction with you in 2002, was meeting with a group of families who were parents of adult children living with developmental disabilities. So these are parents in their 70s and 80s caring for their children in their 40s and 50s with developmental disabilities. For example, Mr. Wood and Deborah, his daughter. But really, how did the families help bring this brokerage model about?
Yeah, and I remember at that time when I heard about the closing of the Fairview Training Center was happening. You know, I used to work in a Catholic church in Northwest Portland, and we started getting some of the people coming to our church from the closing of Fairview, and we were listening to their stories, and we started hearing that, you know, families, after many years of keep coming to, they were put in a waiting list for services at the county, you know, DD offices, and they were waiting and waiting, and they was waiting for a bus that never came in, and they kept coming here to the building and asking legislators, you know, we need supports, we need something, and especially dosaging pens. And the message that they kept getting is, you know, we do care, we love you, but we don't have money. And I know you know that story very well. Finally, they said, we need to do something about it. So they started consulting other parents, other advocates. We started conversations with the states. And at that point, they decided to file a lawsuit. And the lawsuit became a class action, and they decided to settle. The state decided to settle as a recommendation from the Attorney General. So they started, you know, three and a half years ago. And the idea was, individuals belong in their communities, belong to their churches, belong to their schools, belong in the neighborhood, belong in those public transportation buses, belong in their community jobs like Deborah. That's where they belong. And that's what these families wanted. We don't want tolerance. We want full integration. We want to be there. And they started this. And their families started leading the way, giving us feedback. I would say, when I was hired by 30 people, my hiring panel, never been interviewed by 30 people. All 28 of them were consumers and family members. You know what they told me? You know, we don't want to hear how many degrees you have or how many years of experience you have in health and human service. Tell us your story. That's important for us. And I told them my story. But I knew at that point who was at the leadership role, were the parents and the consumers Those were at the lead role. And I would not see this any other way. So this is that. They give us advice how to do this program. They tell us when we are doing something wrong. We put our finances in the open, and we don't hide anything for them. And they appreciate that. So they started this. These moms, and I'll tell you, these moms and dads and these consumers are my heroes, because it is difficult to be a person with a developmental disability and not be fully integrated in the community. So that's how they started. And I'll tell you, I will not change now this job for anything in the world, because I'm very committed to the life of the people that I serve.
Francisco, you blow me away in all the time that I've known you, your commitment to the community that you just expressed to me, but really your role as a catalyst for bringing this change that the families need to see. The families needed hope when they didn't have hope for so many years, and you gave them that hope, and that has spread to the brokerage system as a whole. So you're a hero for me, and you're a hero for, I think, a lot of Oregonians. So thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Francisco, could you tell me approximately what percentage of the adults with this are being served by the brokerages right now?
I just know there are 4,000, but I would like to refer that to staff from SPD. Might you have that answer about what percentage of adults with developmental disabilities are served by the community? This is Mike Naley. He's from Seniors and People with Disabilities, and he might have that exact number.
Or guesstimate.
Nothing.
For the record, my name is Mike Mealy. I work for the Department of Human Services, Seniors and People with Disabilities. And from a functional standpoint, I'm the person responsible for implementing the Staley Settlement agreement. And in terms of when the agreement was settled, we were anticipating about 5,300 people eventually coming in to support brokerages over the course of the settlement agreement. We are now at about 3,700 right in there. And then I think you heard in the earlier testimony the settlement agreement goes to through June of 2009 in terms of this piece of providing services. So we will phase in the remainder of those folks over that time period.
And that is the goal, that all 5,200 would be covered.
Correct. And, of course, these are folks that are on that wait list that has been talked about, and that's a growing number as, in fact, people age into the system, you know, children leaving high school. So we have to keep tabs of that growing number.
Yes, Representative Boone.
One quick question, and I'm sorry I missed your name.
It's Mike.
Mike, how much was the Staley settlement? Do you remember how much money it was represented?
It's multi-years, so you know, we have the numbers, and I could provide that to you. If would you like them in the form of from the very beginning of the funding? Because we've
you
been
have a summary of it.
Because the funding has been from 01, 03, 03, 05, and then there's the proposal for 05, 07, and we have that laid out. So I'd like to be able to just provide that in writing, if that's okay.
Sure.
And I want to make sure, since we're preparing for the Ways and Means testimony, I want to make sure that those numbers are all consistent, so we don't get caught up in giving a bunch of different numbers.
I just want to say also, in the 16-plus years as a legislative assistant here, I met a lot of those parents of disabled, developmentally disabled children who were often adults. And while they were sitting out waiting to talk to various bosses I had throughout the years, they'd say, "Is there anything anybody can do here?" And I says, "Well, I can get you an appointment." And watching the legislators go in and out and all that, and I kind of vowed to myself, boy, if I was ever in that position, I'm going to try to help these people and do something. And coming in here today and hearing about these programs, this is great. And so you've done it for me.
Thank you, Representative.
You've done it for yourselves. Thank you.
All right, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate everybody that participated in that informational hearing, and thank you to the committee for engaging in it. It's an important discussion. With that, we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2479. And Sandy, would you introduce that to us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House Bill 2479 is coming to us at the request of the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. It's requesting that we change the definition of a physician to include podiatrist for the purpose of physician regulatory statutes, for the evidence code statute regarding patient and physician privileges, and insurance code protecting advocacy for patients under medical services contracts. And it's adding podiatrist to a retired physician definition.
Okay, thank you, Sandy. And we'll call Tom Barrows, Kim Garnett, and John Mozena forward, please. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Tom Barrows, representing the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. With me today are Dr. John Mozena, who is the legislative chair of the association, and Dr. Kim Gant, who is the president of the association. We're here today to advocate for House Bill 2479, which would change the definition of physician in Oregon to include doctor of podiatric medicine. As it now sits, physician refers to MD, or medical doctor, and doctor of osteopathy. And I will use some acronyms here and for expediency. Medical doctors and doctors of osteopathy. The training and education for all three are fairly comparable. Dr. Mozena will outline some of that in a few minutes. DPMs have full prescription rights, just like MDs and DOs, and because of that, must have a detailed knowledge of the body and its systems and how they work. So the training is there. Doctors of podiatric medicine are regulated by the Board of Medical Examiners, just as MDs and DOs are. The federal government under Medicare defines doctors of podiatric medicine as physicians, and the U.S. Department of Defense classifies them as Class 1 providers along with MDs and DOs. And the reason for this bill is there have been a number of problems that have been encountered due to not falling into that definition for DPMs. The most common problem that I've encountered has been legislation being written that intended to include them, but because of the use of the word physician, they were excluded, which often meant extra effort, amendments had to be drafted, and oftentimes those didn't occur. An example of this session is Senate Bill 403, which would increase the amount of the rural health tax credit from $5,000 to $10,000 for rural health providers. As it's written, it applies just to physicians. DPMs get that presently, get the $5,000 presently, but as the definition goes, it would only apply to physicians, MDs, and DOs. When I talked to Senator Cruz about this, trying to get an amendment, he indicated that he thought that they were already included in that, and that was the intent, as far as he understood, was to include DPMs in this as well, that everybody that got the tax credit should get the increase as well. In a few minutes, Dr. Gant will talk to you about some other examples of problems that have been encountered with hospital privileges, et cetera. I will give you two more examples of where the definition has caused problems. Prior to about 2 years ago, DPMs, along with MDs and DOs, could dispense medications that they can prescribe. They can still prescribe them. They could dispense them from their offices. The Board of Medical Examiner staff discovered that it said dispensing physician, and so came back and said that they were going to have to remove that privilege for doctors of podiatric medicine. They can still prescribe, give samples, but they cannot dispense now, and that has been removed from the privileges that they have. The other problem, or another problem, I should say, that has been encountered is you'll see a letter right behind, in your packet, right behind my testimony, that talks about Dr. Wellicoff in Yamhill County and another doctor that had patients at the Sheridan Care Clinic late Friday afternoon. They called in prescriptions for antibiotics that they needed, and the head of the care center denied them the ability to give those prescriptions because they weren't physicians. This was a threat to the health of those patients. It was finally resolved, but again, it was took some time, effort, and in the end cost some relationships with the care center because of the difficulties that were encountered. It's my understanding that both the BME and the OMA are going to come out against this bill this session. I do want to thank the OMA representatives for meeting with us this session prior to coming out with it, coming out against it. In my discussions with them, I haven't seen the written testimony today for the Oregon Medical Association, but what I understand to be their main objection is that there'll be confusion on the part of the public if the definition is different. And I don't quite understand this unless patients are consulting the ORS prior to calling a provider. I don't think they'll know there'll be a difference. We specifically put into the bill the caveat that DPM would have to be working within the scope of their license, licensed by the BME, and specifically working within the scope of that license. The definition change will not allow any change in scope of practice. All it will do is avoid some of these problems that we've encountered. If somebody's working outside their scope of practice, this will not change that. They will still be working out and can be called to the carpet for that. I'd like Dr. Mazina to talk to you a little about education now, and then a question.
Question, Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, I'm looking at the Yamhill County materials that you gave us. So as I understand this, on I think the fourth page there, and what the physician had, I guess, it's inappropriate to call him a physician, isn't it? The doctor of podiatry, when the doctor stated in his letter that he could not order a prescription, but that on the fourth page then, it states that nurse practitioners can order physician assistant, licensed nurse, but not a doctor of podiatric medicine. Is that correct?
As my reading, Mr. Chair, Representative Tomei, in my reading under the Division 86 rules that are included here, as I look at it, yes, I mean, you're correct. They cannot under this. And that was the reading that the head of the Sheridan Care Clinic did, in a literal reading off the rules and the statutes. That's why she denied them the ability to write that. Others, I believe, continue to write prescriptions and not have a problem. But sometimes this occurs if somebody
doesn't. And these materials you gave us, is this part of the statute?
That, I believe, is part of the rules for nursing homes, I believe.
Oh,
Representative
nursing homes.
I believe that's what it is. I didn't identify. I'm sorry. That was part of the letter that I got, so I just included it here to demonstrate.
It's an administrative rule. Yeah.
It's an administrative rule that comes from a law that the legislature passed. Is that, am I correct in assuming that?
Mr. Chair, Representative May, yes.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Tom.
President Greenlake.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a general question and a specific question. What I hear you saying, and I want to make sure I'm correct, is that this isn't the purpose of this and the effect of this is not to create different categories of compensation. I mean, not to increase places where podiatrists can be compensated where they would not currently be compensated, nor to change their privileges in any sense by the simple name change from pediatric physicians to physicians. Is that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlake, as I think I understand your question, correct. We're not trying, it is not the intent to gain new privileges except those that should be. The dispensing that has been lost, reimbursement for Medicare that already is considered under the federal government, but sometimes has been we've had difficulties having that come through, hospital privileges, things like that, sort of inadvertent because of the definition, not trying to change the scope or gain new areas of treatment. If I understand your question.
Any follow-up? And can you look at page 5, line
of the
20
bill?
Of the 2479, your proposed. It looks like that line changes the designation of what we now call physicians to calling them non-podiatric physicians. Is that?
Which line, please?
20.
I'm looking at line 20 on 5. Right now, we know physicians are physicians licensed under 677. They're people with degrees in osteopathy or degrees in medicine and licensed physicians. Looks like the purpose of this line, whereas before it had that definition, this line talked about hospital staff comprised of physicians or podiatric physicians. would now read non-podiatric physicians and podiatric physicians. So the effect of this would to change the title of MDs to DOs to non-podiatric physicians. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, only in sections like this where it intends to exclude doctors of podiatric medicine.
May I follow? But they're not excluded by the definition there, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, you're correct in terms of the whole, but if it said physicians or podiatric physicians and surgeons, there would be a redundancy there because it has the or both aspect.
Oh,
so I think you need to separate them within this section here, and so that's why I believe that's why Legislative Council put non-podiatric there.
And it isn't redundant anymore? What's the difference by... it seems to me it's even more redundant than it was before.
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, this was not anything that we provided. This was put in by Legislative Council. Our operative language is on page 7, I believe, changing the definition and adding this license by the board and working within the scope of that license. So anything else that is in the bill is Legislative Council's changing statute to fit within that mold to qualify it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, thank you. Representative Greenlick, I see your point. Probably need to have some work done on that line. Okay, go ahead and proceed.
Before I turn over to Dr. Messina, I have a call into the Osteopathic Physicians and Surgeons Association, the new name, to Jeff Hetherington. I've not heard back. The last two sessions when we've had a similar bill up, they have been okay with the bill. And Dr. Messina now will talk about some of the education that DPMs must have.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Dr. John Messina. I'm a doctor of podiatric medicine. I'd like to thank you today for the opportunity to speak in front of you on such an important health care issue that we have in our legislation today. A doctor of podiatric medicine deals with the diagnosis of the medical, surgical, or physical treatment of the ailments of the human foot. With this bill, we're not looking to enlarge our scope of practice, but we want to further define it. Our goal is simply to have those trained in modern medicine with the proper undergraduate degrees, 4 years of medical school, and postgraduate training in a surgical residency who already are grouped together in the Medical Practice Act to now be grouped together under the definition of physician, hoping to stop any current unfounded prejudice that we experience. I'd like to talk about my training first. My training began with 5 years at the University of Oregon, followed by 4 years at the medical school at California College of Podiatric Medicine. I then completed a surgical residency in San Diego and eventually started as an associate in Beaverton, Oregon. For the last 20 years, I've been on my own in solo practice in Clackamas. I'm board certified by the American Board of Podiatric Surgery and the fellow in the American College of Foot and Ankle Surgeons. I'm on staff at 5 different hospitals with knitting privileges and have served on multiple hospital committees. These committee memberships in the past have included Chief of Staff at Medical Center Hospital, Surgical Residency Director for 6 years, Assistant Chief of Surgery at Eastmoreland Hospital, serving on Osteopathic Medical Education Committee, which hires and trains the family practice residents. I've published approximately 20 different articles in the national medical literature and have lectured nationally. Personally, I've coached about 35 kids sports teams, run marathons, and have a rock and roll band. The following is a typical curriculum for a podiatric medical student. General anatomy, including full cadaver dissection, biochemistry, histology, physiology, microbiology, pathology, physical diagnosis, including performing a complete comprehensive medical, physical, and history exam, pharmacology, general medical studies and courses, including hematology, renal studies, cardiovascular studies, GI studies, endocrine, and behavioral medicine. These courses may sound very familiar to you in the trainings that are received by the DOs and the MDs. And the reason that these sound very similar is because in many cases they're exactly the same. In fact, in one institution, the University of Osteopathic Health Sciences in Des Moines, Iowa, DPMs and DOs sit in the exact same classroom for the first 2 years. I had a chance to call Dr. Yoho and asked him, how do the DPMs and DOs fare with each other after 2 years of being in the same classroom together? His comment was, they have no statistical difference on how they academically fare with each other. Dr. Jay Levrio, the Deputy Executive Director of the American Podiatric Medical Association, he confirmed the study is currently ongoing within our association, which should be completed within the next few months. It's anticipated that this comparison of the educations of the MD, the DO, and the DPM will reveal an extensive parallel education curriculum. The majority of our patients, who average about 100 of your constituents a week, are referred to us by MD and DO physicians. Many of these support our cause in the definition of physicians, and I have a couple of letters that I've had from my particular physicians, friends, write for me to show our support. Many of the physicians are trained in 5 years, such as myself, and as many of the family practitioners are in the state of Oregon. However, throughout the nation, a 2-year surgical residency is now becoming the standard, and after 4 years of medical school, now, as recently, a 3-year program is becoming the norm. The only podiatric residency program in Oregon currently resides at Legacy Good Samaritan, and it's a 3-year program after the 4 years of medical school. This residency includes the same rotations that the MDs and DOs are currently taking, and they participate side by side. In fact, some of the MDs and DO residency programs, in particular the family practice rotations, they rotate through the podiatry offices. In fact, my office. I've had the DO students and the MD students rotate through my office. I was also fortunate enough to be named Clinician of the Year by Eastmoreland Hospital's DO residency program in the year 2000-2001. I'd like to end my discussion with a recent scene from the Presidential Room of the United States Senate. Senator Edward Kennedy, the ranking minority member of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, stated the following: "I know what podiatrists do," as he removed his shoes and pulled out an orthotic. "I currently support the definition of podiatrists as physicians federally. This is in the Medicaid Title IX legislation, and this is to align itself with current definition in Medicare. We are trained in the same and similar institutions. We have the same philosophy of medicine. We take the same classes. We have many of the same hospital rotations side by side. We rotate with each other through each other's offices. And this is why we are not asking for special rights, but we are asking for equal rights, by our defined by our education, to be called physician. Thank you for your time."
President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question that I've had several times during Dr. Mozina's testimony, and that is, I would like to have some delineation of this education. We talked about extensive parallel education side by side, taking many of the same classes, first 2 years of education with DOs. Is there some kind of a chart we could look at to see where this starts to separate out, so that we can get a better feel for this, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, in your packet you'll see some information that Dr. Mozina gathered, a curricular comparison between MD institutions, DPM institutions. I tried to do a sort of matrix to compare the two side by side rather than having to look at the 4 medical schools and the 1 DPM school. The problem is a lot of times they'll be categorized differently. Some will be merged into 2 topics with a certain number of hours, whereas the other ones have it split out into 2 separate topics. It was difficult to get an actual sort of matrix because it was all over the board with the 4 medical schools. So I apologize we didn't have something boiled down for you a little more clearly, but you can look at that chart and kind of make the comparisons.
Just for clarification, Mr. Chair, that's this item that shows the number of weeks in each of the various courses in these various institutions.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Greenlee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I listened carefully to your testimony, and it seems to me the force of your testimony is to say that doctors of podiatry and doctors of medicine and doctors of osteopathy are the same, and that's why they should all be called the same thing.
Within our scope of practice, you're exactly correct, Representative Greenlee. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
You didn't limit it within your scope of practice in your testimony. It seems to me Mr. Barrows testified that he thought the OMA was going to say people might be confused by putting the names together. I think you've confused me with your testimony. It seemed to me, if you listen to your testimony, nowhere did you say, well, within scope of practice, it's the same. You said over and over in your testimony, basically, doctors of podiatry and doctors of medicine and doctors of osteopathy are equivalent. That's what I heard you saying.
Actually, at the beginning of my testimony, I did outline what the law states, our law states for our current scope of practice. We're not looking to enlarge our scope of practice. We're not looking for anything that's not entitled to us by our education and within the law. All we're looking for is to further define who we are. And if you read the very first paragraph that I stated, was I was just strictly trying to define what our law is. We are nothing, looking for nothing more, Representative. All we're looking for is to be defined who we are by our education. Nothing outside of our scope of practice, sir.
You're actually talking about changing your law, so that's the issue here. That's the point we're here today. If you were talking about changing the law, then this wouldn't be an issue, and you wouldn't be here. I'm sitting next to a doctor of dentistry who doesn't feel he wants to be called a physician, at least not today, even though who knows tomorrow. And I do need to state I'm a faculty member in the School of Medicine, although not a physician, and happy to be not a physician in that position. But I did hear you essentially, with your use of simile and other things, talk about basically these are the same. And the fact, if that's the force of what you're trying to do, is to make equivalence between doctors of podiatry, doctors of medicine, doctors of osteopathy, then it laid some credence to the claim that Mr. Barrow said we're going to be hearing shortly. So maybe you could help me a little bit with that.
Well, I think that...
Are you the same?
I think that we are exactly the same within our scope of practice. I think that is, the smokes and mirrors can become taken out and looking and say, oh, these guys are trying to enlarge on what they do and who they are. Not in any shape or any form. We just want to be who we are. We're not asking for anything extra. We are want to practice within our scope, and we want to be called a physician as what we are. We define it with our education. We define it within our practice on a daily basis and with our patients. Many of our patients are representatives and senators within our community. We just want to be who we are, and I don't see anything different in what I said and what you're saying. If it wants to clarify it further, I can very simply say, within our scope of practice, I want to be considered a physician. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Greenlee. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tom, I guess I want to talk with you a little bit more about your presentation and what you've written. It seems to me that the bottom line is, like, Mitch could be called doctor. Representative Anderson can be doctor. They're doctor. Dentistry, I don't know what your doctorate is.
I'm a doctor.
I know.
PhD doctor.
Thank you. Doctor of philosophy, whatever. You could call me a master if you want to. Master in philosophy.
As you wish. If you're as vice chair, you are my master.
Thank you for acknowledging that.
Oh, my God.
So, I guess what it seems to me the bottom line is what we're after today is to be able to get some of the perks that come with whatever physician allow, such as being able to write prescriptions, right?
Mr. Chair, Representative May, they can already write prescriptions, the full range, just like anyone else. What they cannot do now because of the interpretation of the definition is dispense with
right,
their offices.
Right, and so
yes.
that is one of the things that you want to be able to do. Another one, as I understand it, is that perhaps you're not allowed the tax credit, the rural tax credit. It seems, am I correct in...
Mr. Chair, Representative May, they presently get the tax credit under the bill that's been written to increase the tax credit from $5,000 to $10,000 for rural tax credit recipients. They would not get the increase.
Right.
Because it was written with physician.
Right. So what you're after, as I understand it, is these things that come with the title of physician. Am I correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative May, to a great deal, yes. I mean, yeah, that is, there are a number of places that we've outlined experiences that have been problematic because of the definition. I don't know that they're trying to gain necessarily new rights, more just
right.
Maintain the rights that they already have or should have.
And that many of us have assumed that they had, and that somehow were lost, in the last legislative session.
Or in some cases never given, though expected to be given.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. Okay. Dr. Gant.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for allowing us to be here and make these statements before you. My purpose is, to give a couple of examples of where the change of definition from podiatric physician to physician would be a benefit to us.
Dr. Gant, can I have you introduce yourself for the record?
Yes, I'm Dr. Kim Gant. I'm the president of the Oregon Podiatric Medical Association. I'm in private practice and with offices in Newburgh and Hillsboro.
Thank you.
There are a number of instances where we as podiatrists are not allowed to practice within our scope of practice to the level of our training and ability, plain and simply because we're not defined by physician in Oregon law. This is not only a problem for us professionally, but also directly affects the health care of the patients that we serve and frequently causes a delay in treatment and a waste of limited health care resources within the state. For example, in many hospitals in Oregon, podiatrists are not afforded specific privileges such as completing a history and physical on patients simply because they do not have the physician status. Many hospitals list podiatrists under allied health categories, practitioners such as psychologists and respiratory therapists. Only physicians in these facilities are the types of doctors afforded those privileges in those facilities. Interestingly, the Joint Commission on Hospital Accreditation, which accredits all hospitals in the United States to receive public funding, specifically allows podiatrists to do history and physicals in these facilities, and yet the facilities continue to block us because we do not have the definition of physician. We are called podiatric physician and surgeon. Therefore, we are put in a different category, which is frequently allied health. When this occurs, this causes a delay in the treatment of these patients, as these individuals must then see their primary care physician for the history and physical. This not only causes a delay in treatment, but it causes a delay in the money being exchanged, meaning it gets spread further and further when we have limited resources, because in the current managed care environment, many, if most, not most insurers, will not pay for a screening history and physical on a healthy individual. Therefore, the primary care physicians who now have to do the physicals for our patients to have surgery or be admitted to the hospital are not being paid for those services. They are now refusing to do them. The patient's caught in the middle. They have a doctor of podiatric medicine who cannot do the history and physical in the facility. They have a primary care physician who refuses to do the history and physical because not being paid, and therefore the patient's caught in the middle. This is a waste of time and resources when it can be fairly simply overcome, in my opinion, by a change in definition. We all have instances also in healthcare, that is third-party payers, insurance companies, that are disallowing treatment by podiatrists, and again, they explain it as we are not physicians and therefore we cannot provide a specific service. For example, which happened in my practice in the last 6 months. The procedure of diagnostic ultrasound is a non-invasive technique of imaging within the human body and is very frequently used within our offices. Even though we're well within the scope of practice to provide this care, which is a very safe practice, some insurance companies are not allowing us to provide that care, refusing payment and refusing that care because only physicians can provide that examination. The next option for this, if we cannot do those ultrasound examinations in our office, is a trip to the hospital and an MRI. The difference, again, is if we can do an ultrasound in our office, we can do it at the time of visit, and the cost is about $125 to the individual or the insurance company, as opposed to having to take a trip to the hospital where they have to make an appointment for this exam, more than likely have to take more time off, and the cost of an MRI is comparatively about $800 for the foot. We can only anticipate this trend to increase over time, and this is limiting treatment, delaying treatment, and causing more pressure on an overburdened system of healthcare dollars. There's some concern about confusing the public by passing this bill. I, in fact, believe the change will clarify to the public just who we are, what we do, how we're trained, and what we can do. That's already defined in the scope of practice for podiatrists. But we find regularly in our offices currently a confusion of our patients and by our patients because they assume already that we are physicians by law. Simply said, we as podiatrists are held to the same standards of practice in all aspects of our profession as our MD and DO colleagues, all of whom are licensed by the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. we are simply not afforded the same recognition of our education and training. Being defined within Oregon law as physician will allow greater patient access, less delay in treatment, and at a lessened cost to the patient and the healthcare system as a whole. Thank you.
Thanks, Dr. Kant. Representative Butler, and then Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would yield first to Representative Tomei.
Oh, because lady. I'm a master.
Master and lady. And you call me dad. That's great.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Now you've got me confused. Dr. Gant, thanks for your testimony. I'm a little bit confused. I followed you until you were talking about doing a physical exam. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's clear what your scope of practice is as a right. podiatric physician. But I get a little concerned when you're talking about doing a physical exam. If your exam, I mean, we've been hearing a lot about examination of women, et cetera, in the last sure. few weeks. Surely that's not the kind of exam that you would be qualified to do.
No.
Am I correct?
That's correct. Typically, we are required, or the patient is required, to have a specific level of history and physical for most often outpatient surgery. It usually includes heart, lungs, upper respiratory, that kind of thing. We don't usually, and in fact, I know of no one, and it would be out of our scope to do any other exam.
Follow-up. So it would be within your scope of practice to examine someone for heart disease or lung disease? Is that what you're saying?
It would be within our scope to do the history and physical to allow those patients to be admitted. And those are usually, in fact, they are class 1 and class 2 patients, and I'll explain that. The Anesthesiologists Association has classifications of patients. Class 1 would be a healthy patient with no chronic diseases. Class 2 would be a patient with chronic diseases under control, such as hypertension, high blood pressure, diabetes. Class 3 would be somebody who has chronic diseases that are out of control, and class 4 would be an at-risk patient for anybody to undergo any type of surgical procedure in any form. The hospitals, the way we are credentialed, typically allow us to do, when we can do them in the facilities, are in Class 1 and Class 2 physicians, and that's the way the Joint Commission views it, meaning people that are either very healthy or patients that are stable with their chronic disease.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
President Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have four questions, but in the essence of time, I'd just go ahead and I'd like for Tom to answer three of them. I think Drs. Mozina and Dr. Gant could answer the other one. The first question I had is relative to the 1999 scope of practice issues that we had. As I recall, in 1999, we had an issue of expansion of scope of practice. I don't remember how that all got settled out, but there was some discussion at that particular point. Second question I had was, relative to your testimony, the second issue, that is the orders to dispense from their offices as opposed to writing prescriptions, I'm wondering if that can't be resolved in legislation, and is there potentially legislation out there that would address this? The third question is relative to the insurance code issues that have been brought up today, and I'm wondering if that couldn't be handled with legislation through the DCBS, where the insurance industry would be directed to recognize the doctors of podiatric medicine. And the final question I had, and this is the one for the doctors here, Dr. Zina and Dr. Gant, and that is the relative numbers of doctors of podiatric medicine versus MDs and DOs. I don't want to take a great deal of time, but those are just some questions that I've had that have come up from this presentation.
Perhaps
the number would be easy to address in a hurry.
If I may answer that? To my knowledge, the current statistics, the number of podiatrists licensed by the Board of Medical Examiners for Oregon is just under 170, 165, 168 in that range. And the numbers of MDs and DOs licensed by the same body is a bit over 12,000.
Thank you.
I'm Mr. Chair, Representative Butler. I'm not sure I understand your question regarding the scope of practice. In 1999, there was a bill. A bill was passed by this body and signed by the governor that clarified the scope of practice to include ankle surgery for those that met the qualifications for it, and it had some pretty strict qualifications written by the Board of Medical Examiners to outline just who was qualified and who was not. Is that what your question was? Was that
yes? Just how that was resolved and what the scope was expanded to at that particular point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler,
I would argue it wasn't really expanded, it was clarified. Prior to that, it was a vague ailments of the foot, which has been defined all over the country in different ways, and we tried to break it down to a more specific line so that people knew exactly where that line was, that there wasn't concern that they might be moving outside the scope depending on how somebody might interpret it. That was the goal of that, and I think successfully. I don't think there have been any problems that I've heard of since that passed. As far as the question regarding dispensing, certainly that could be dealt with in separate legislation, as could insurance code, as could a number of things. The problem is we have to continually make these changes in a number of bills, and we felt that with one bill here we could solve all those problems without causing any other problems with a scope of expansion or anything like that.
Thank you.
Representative Cameron?
Yes, thank you. Dr. Gant, you mentioned cases where a primary physician refused to do a physical in a hospital. I mean, you've witnessed that?
Yes.
Because
they aren't going to be paid for the screening history and physical by the insurance company. Because, for instance, if it's a patient that we're taking in for bunion corrective surgery, that individual physician is not treating the bunion surgery. They are not doing the bunion treatment. Therefore, they don't have a diagnosis to put for that history and physical, which the insurance industry requires for them to be paid. It's a screening history and physical to make sure they're healthy enough to undergo anesthesia.
So what happens in that case?
It's a difficult situation. Sometimes I make a few phone calls and find a friendly primary care doctor who will step in and take care of that under those situations.
So it usually ends up happening in some way, and the other guy that refused probably is not called on in the future.
Not fired, correct.
Representative Cameron, we also have issues with when this happens that we sometimes will have to call in the anesthesia to do our history and physical. Many hospitals across the state now allow us to do our own history and physical prior to admission on outpatient surgeries, however. So we sometimes will have to change the hospital, which may be an insurance issue for some patients that may be covered less. They may not be as well insured at one hospital versus another.
And then you also referred to a scan. I didn't catch the technical term. If I came to your office, a scan that that you weren't able to do or you weren't paid to do, but you'd have to refer me to a hospital, which would cost $800 or $1,000 to do that. If an individual is paying for that themselves, can you legally do that scan in your office?
Yes.
Okay. So it's an insurance reimbursement issue, not a legal
issue. It's a reimbursement issue based simply on the fact, and the insurance told us on the phone, because you're not a physician, you can't do that exam.
Do you need to have this law changed to have you described as a physician to accomplish all the individual things that you want? I know Mr. Barrows testified that we probably could get the dispensing and the insurance code and all those issues. And I'm just wanting to hear from the podiatrist to explain to us why it's necessary, to clarify why it's necessary to change the law to include podiatrists, doctors of podiatric medicine in the physician arena.
Well, I guess from my standpoint, and you're going to get my view from professional and personal, I guess both. Every 2 years the legislature meets, so that means every 2 years we'd have to resubmit something. And it may be something fairly minor. It's a tough thing to do for us. We're a small association, we're 168 licensees, and probably only about 120 of us physically practice in the state of Oregon. Some of those licensees are out of state, and I know some of the people personally because I trained with them and I know where they're licensed. Also, because we're spread out pretty thinly across the state, you can imagine with that number covering the state of Oregon, it's very difficult for us to go out and fight the individual battles at each hospital each time they occur. I take a lot of phone calls every week from our members that are having trouble with a hospital and insurance company. Something else has come up, and it's continual. And we're hoping to resolve these problems. And again, it's not a scope of practice change. This is just simply we're requesting recognition for our level of training and education. And hopefully we can overcome some of the hurdles that we face pretty much daily. And again, it's not just a professional concern. It's a concern for our patients. We have patients that get delayed treatment, costly treatment, and maybe inappropriate treatment sometimes because of the delay.
Okay. Additional questions or comments?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Greenlee.
I'm interested in trying to figure out who ought to be called doctors with this, and I've heard this argument from doctors of optometry, naturopathic physicians. One-time dentists were doctors of stomatology, right? There are a whole series of people with doctor's degrees that treat patients. Do you think they all ought to be called physicians? Or some of them? Or just you? And if so, what's the criteria that we ought to be using when we're sitting here trying to say, yeah, this one's a physician, but no, that one's not a physician?
Representative Greenlicka, your point's well taken, and we've thought this over ourselves. One of the issues that we have versus some of the other people that have a doctorate behind their name is philosophy differences. The medical physician is trained as an allopath. A naturopath is trained in a special philosophy that is naturopathic medicine. Chiropractic is chiropractic medicine. The optometric physician, he is trained as an optometrist. They are trained as an osteopath. We are trained as an allopath. We do not have any unique philosophy. We have nothing unique that makes us any different than the MDs or DOs that we deal with. We are strictly, because of our education, a doctor of podiatric medicine. We don't want to align ourselves with any particular group, but this is who we are, and with our education, including our postgraduate training, which puts us in a special category, and that's our three-year residency that we currently have. Many are coming out with in Oregon.
Was that a yes or a no on those others?
What I'm trying to point out to you is that it's very straightforward in that we don't have any difference in philosophy with the allopathic medicine where the others do. So we are considered a physician, as are the osteopaths and are the MDs.
Is that a yes or a no?
Within the scope of practice, we are considered a physician. The others are not considered a physician. They are considered a naturopathic physician, a chiropractic physician.
I understand. Thank you, sir.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am impressed with the level of basic science and training that the doctor of podiatric medicine undergoes. And I guess I've been listening to this debate. I guess my real question, because I think some of the issues that you'd like to see taken care of can be taken care of, possibly in the Senate bill that's already in the works. But my question, it keeps coming back, well, why aren't the DPMs going to medical school and becoming a total physician with a subspecialty in foot surgery? As a dentist, you know, we get pretty much the same education that you do, that the MD does. Not quite, but very, very close. And yet we're proud to stay separate as a subspecialty just on the oral cavity and surrounding areas. Mm-hmm. And if you really wish to become a physician, which I don't think most dentists do, why don't you become a physician? Why don't you merge with the medical schools and take the same as you do, the same training, and become a physician, period. With a subspecialty.
Representative Anderson, that's actually a very good point, and that's exactly our point. The schools are starting to merge, and the University of Osteopathic Health Science Centers do have the DPMs and the DOs in the exact same classroom. Things are starting to happen that direction as we speak. We are unique in our training, and I appreciate you recognizing that fact. But the reality of it is there has been a lack of training in foot and ankle medicine and surgery. We have taken up that banner. There's articles, for example, in the Foot and Ankle, 2003 July, talks about the lack of training with some of the other physicians that are having currently the MD programs, and we are taking up that banner and running with it. So we're not trying to knock anybody out. We're just trying to push forward with our particular education and our degree.
Can I chair?
Yeah.
When you're trained in the school of...
Let me follow.
I'm sorry.
I wasn't thinking so much knocking somebody out, but rather for you to become what I think the public recognizes as a physician is someone who can treat the whole body, who's trained to treat the whole body, that may have recommendations on diabetes, may have recommendations on neurosurgery, but your specialty, where you spend your time, is on the foot, like the orthopedic surgeon.
Well, we are very much a specialist, Representative Anderson, much like the ophthalmologist or the dermatologist.
Sure.
However, they don't treat diabetes, longitudinal care. They would refer it to an internist, as we would.
But they're licensed to give opinions in those the fields. They probably wouldn't want to. But they have full licensure to do that, I believe.
I understand.
Thank you.
Okay. Thanks very much. Next, we'll call Kathleen Haley forward, please.
Good morning, Chair Dalto, members of the committee. My name is Kathleen Haley, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Board of Medical Examiners. And the board has responsibility for the licensing, discipline, and investigation as part of that discipline for physicians, physician assistants, podiatrists, and acupuncturists. And the board's primary mission is to protect the public of Oregon. When we look at the difference in the education and training between physicians and podiatric physicians, what we see is that physicians go to medical school, podiatric physicians go to podiatric medical school, different schools. When we look at the training, the postgraduate training, physicians who are trained to treat the whole body have generally 7 to 8 years of postgraduate training, whereas most podiatric physicians have 5. So there are some ongoing differences there. Well, the physicians who spoke to you, podiatric physicians who just spoke to you, would like to see changes there. Those changes do not exist today. Podiatrists in Oregon are allowed to treat the foot and the ankle and perform ankle surgery in licensed hospitals or ambulatory surgical centers in Oregon. And that was passed in the 1999 session. But right now there are only a handful that have that training and that ability to do that ankle surgery. Podiatrists do have physician in their title. And that qualifier, I think, is important for the public to know who is going to be able to diagnose and treat their conditions. Just as you mentioned in your earlier questions, chiropractic physician tells the patient who is going to be treating them. So also does podiatric physician. I reviewed through the National Federation of Podiatric Medical Boards all the other states, and I could not find any other state that called podiatric physicians simply physician. In most cases, they are called podiatrists. So there are other concerns that would fall from this statutory change as well. But the board does not have any intention of wanting to exclude podiatric physicians from the rural tax credit or the ability to dispense. I think those are things that all would agree should happen and should be taken care of this legislative session if it could be done.
Can I stop you right there?
Yes.
Aren't there any podiatrists on the board?
Chair Dalto, right now there's a podiatric council, the members of which are appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate, and that's the only council or committee under the board in which that appointment takes place that way. When the board is reviewing cases involving podiatric physicians, those cases first go through that council, and a member of the council or another podiatrist from the community who may have expertise in that area will step forward and meet with the board's investigative committee, and while not a voting member, does advise the committee, mm-hmm. and then again advises the full board before any discipline is taken.
So
would
no,
have a say
right.
in discipline as well.
That's a no, right?
They don't have any vote, no. They don't have.
But there's not a podiatrist on the board.
Okay. Chair Dalto, that's correct.
What my question was.
That's correct.
Okay, so go ahead.
Okay. I think that in listening to the earlier testimony, the issue about hospital credentialing, I'm not sure that changing podiatric physicians to physicians is going to change the credentialing process, because there is still that limitation in the scope of practice to the ailments of the foot and ankle. So I don't think we're going to take care of that problem with this bill. The board also firmly believes that podiatric physicians should get their full compensation and reimbursement that they're due for the treatment that they provide. But at the bottom line, the board also believes that in its mission of protecting the public, that this bill does not further that, and in fact further confuses the public who need to be served in Oregon. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions?
Yes.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Kathleen, for your presentation today. So, I've taken some notes for myself. So, how do you propose that the problems that the podiatrists have brought forward today about not being able to dispense prescriptions, not being reimbursed, etc., not being able to, what was the problem about the having a physician, an MD or a DO, do whatever was necessary so that they could do the tests, the physical exam, and also the ultrasounds inside their facility. How do you propose that those problems be addressed?
Chair Dalto, Representative Tomei, I don't know that I have all the answers today. I know that Senate Bill 469 is out there that would recognize podiatrists' ability to provide care under the workers' compensation bill. I think that perhaps another bill could be drafted relative to the dispensing, and certainly there should be clarification on the rural tax credit issue. And I don't have an answer for you about having physicians. It sounds to me like there are some ongoing issues in that individual community about why attending physicians aren't willing to do that history and physical, and I'm afraid I don't know all the background about that one.
Okay. Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Cameron?
Yes. Are there other categories of physicians that aren't represented on the board besides the category we're referring to today?
Chair Dalto, Representative Cameron, that naturopathic physicians have their own board, as do chiropractic physicians.
Which are overseen by your board?
No, they have their own boards.
Okay.
So the podiatrists then are the only practitioners that are under your authority that don't have their own board? Is that what you're saying?
Chair Dalto, they're the only other than physicians, podiatric physicians are under the board by choice. They came to the board and asked to be put under the board.
No, I understand. So, but I just want to make this clear. There aren't any podiatrists on your board, but the BME has authority over all podiatrists by their choice, is what you're saying?
That's correct, Chair Dalton.
Okay, and so, but there is the Advisory Council of Podiatry that consults with your board.
That's true, Chair Dalton.
Okay, and by the way, did you consult with them on House Bill 2479?
I called each member of the Podiatric Council, yes. And
what was their sense?
Their sense, what I gathered from discussing this with them, is that there are difficulties with reimbursement. That was what I was hearing repeatedly in my discussions with them. I did hear also that there are parallels in the first 2 years of the educational process, but that after that, the focus is on the foot and ankle for podiatric physicians, whereas it's for the whole body for physicians.
Okay, but did they take a position on this bill?
Chair Dalton, no, they did not. Not as a group. They're going to meet this Friday, and we'll discuss it again.
Okay. And will the Board of Medical Examiners meet to discuss these bills?
Chair Dalton, the Legislative Committee of the Board has met and has taken this position in opposition.
Okay. All right. No, Representative Cameron. Okay. It doesn't look like we have any additional questions, so I appreciate you being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And then we'll invite Scott Gallant forward. Good morning. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Scott Gallant. I represent the Oregon Medical Association. I actually have a fairly long testimony, but I don't actually like it. So I thought I'd try to, I think it needs to be simplified, to be honest with you. So I'm going to try to address some of the issues that were raised by earlier testimony. First of all, the Medical Association does, in fact, have concerns about this bill. We don't think it really addresses the issues that have been raised and would, in fact, cause confusion among the public. As has been stated before, one of the issues that was raised, for example, was Senate Bill 403, which is a bill that would increase the rural health tax credit. I was somewhat involved in the development of that legislation, and I guess I could plead guilty in the sense that our theory at suggesting that the legislation be introduced is that it be narrow in order to reduce the fiscal impact, understanding that we are in fairly tight fiscal times. It was not done to really offend anyone, and I might add there have been others, nurse practitioners and others, who have indicated that they would like to be included in that legislation. I'm sure they're going to have an opportunity to, in fact, make that case. My only concern, again, was not to weigh a bill down that might not be able to make it through the process, because it's critical that we continue to be able to recruit and retain positions in rural Oregon. So, I guess I'm guilty for having represented MDs and DOs in requesting the introduction of the bill. Senator Cruz has also talked to me as well, and again asked whether the Medical Association would have objections to that being expanded. My response was the same. If it doesn't kill the bill, hopefully if it gets considered and moved either on the Senate side or potentially legislation on the House side, we would not have any objection to that. So that's that issue in and of itself. In regard to insurance issues, I think many of you know, having had experience on these committees before, that physicians generally, obviously podiatric physicians specifically, at times have difficulty getting coverage for services that have been provided or might be provided. Let me give you a personal example. A number of years ago, before PET scans became quite ordinary in the course of diagnosis for some illnesses, diseases, my wife needed one and was ordered by an oncologist. The insurer denied coverage for that diagnostic test. We ultimately prevailed. We paid cash for it, by the way. We ultimately prevailed in getting coverage after appealing with the insurer. But my point is this. This sort of fight between physicians and providers of healthcare services, dentists or others, happens every day. And it's common. It's not limited to any one particular practitioner. It's actually affects just about all practitioners at one time or another. And so one shouldn't be surprised by that. I don't believe, and our council doesn't believe, in reading this legislation that it resolves that issue as raised by the proponents of the bill. In regard to hospital privileges, there's a specific statute in Oregon law that says that hospitals must provide privileges for physicians of podiatric medicine. Now, physicians, obviously, but not all physicians, have privileges in hospitals, but even physicians who have privileges often are limited to the area of their expertise in a hospital facility. That is no different than other practitioners, and I would agree with Representative Greenland. Some of the language, not only in the modifications for who in fact determines the standard of care in hospital facilities, has typically been the medical staff. It's also up to the board of a hospital to meet the appropriate level of care for all of their patients, including patients who receive podiatric physician services. So there are distinctions among physicians as well as other personnel. Again, I don't believe this bill actually addresses or fixes that issue. In fact, I think it confuses the matter to a great degree, just like the section of the bill that talks about the rural health tax credit. I think the net effect of the change to non-podiatric physician may in fact exclude practitioners who currently get the rural health tax credit, who don't have hospital privileges, but who can cause someone to be admitted into a rural health facility from receiving that tax credit. And so I don't think it is artfully drafted. I apologize to legislative council if they're listening. They usually yell at me when I say those things. But I do think it is particularly confusing. The distinctions, I think that was also raised by many of the committee today. There are distinctions made both in federal law and in state law so that the public is in fact aware of the extent of health care services that a practitioner can make. The current law in Oregon actually is very clear about what the scope is for podiatric physicians. And merely rolling podiatric physicians into the definition of physician would do less in clarifying their important services than leaving the statute as it is today. I guess in summary, the bill doesn't really address the issues as we view it that have been raised. Those issues are very targeted issues, and this bill goes well beyond that. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Scott, you've been around the building a long time.
And I'm very old.
You are very old, and we all may need the assistance of physicians, and I know I need the assistance of podiatrists on a regular basis. My concern would be that you've heard a number of issues raised today dealing with the rural tax credit, dealing with issues relative to providing the prescription drugs necessary, orders to dispense, as well as being able to address issues of insurance. Do you believe in your experience that a bill with a relating clause relating to podiatry could be used to access these concerns at the DCBS and with insurance and with the pharmacology boards and those other folks?
It may not reach to I think it reaches just about all of them. It may not reach the statutes in regard to reimbursement. But I would have to check, and I'd be happy to. Actually, the fix for dispensing medications is really pretty simple to do. The fix to make sure that podiatric physicians are under the physician-patient privilege is easy to do as well, and we wouldn't have objections to that.
Thank you.
Okay. But you don't need to change the definition.
All right, it's just one quick question. This is on the other bill, 2490. Your opinion of allowing the podiatrist to have a spot on the Board of Medical Examiners.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for asking. I have spent a lot of my adult career trying to assure that the Board of Medical Examiners' first and most important focus is on regulating and disciplining physicians of medicine and osteopathy. We would not support this change. First of all, we think it's absolutely disproportionate in numbers of licensees. The board members have broad expertise, and I think they fairly and appropriately regulate not only the practice of podiatric medicine, but acupuncturists and physician assistants who are also under the Board of Medical Examiners.
Okay, all right. Thanks very much, Mr. Gallant. We're over time, so appreciate you condensing your remarks. We will close the public hearing on 2479 and adjourn the meeting.